Gonna rock these shades. Gonna scream my name. Make you shout now, honey. Gonna make you shout.
Whether you're an independent artist looking to take their career to the next level, or you're a fan that just loves to discover new artists and new original music, Making a Scene has exactly what you're looking for. For the indie artist, we have articles on music business, gear reviews, recording techniques, and interviews with industry professionals. For the fan, we introduce you to new artists every day with our in-depth artist interviews and insightful CD reviews. Nobody gives you more. Making a Scene truly is the number one resource for the indie artist and the fans that love them. Go to makingascene.org and become part of the indie revolution. And now, here's an indie blues double shot from our featured artist today, Mike Zito. And stay tuned for that interview. It comes up right after these songs.
I don't know my left from my right. but you don't have me. No, you don't have me. You don't have me. No, you don't have me. You got everything that a girl would want. Oh, but you don't have me.
Zito from his brand new release, and we got Mike Zito on the line. Hey, Mike, how you been?
I've been doing good, Rich. How about you?
You know, I'm doing pretty well. I'm trying to stay out of trouble, but my wife keeps telling me I'm not real good at it, so what are you going to do?
They have higher standards than we do.
Yeah, I guess so. Now, you know, you've been on the show before, but we always like to give our fans this opportunity to kind of get to know who you are as an artist by the journey that you've taken. So give us the story of Mike Zito.
Well, you know, I grew up in South St. Louis in the city, and lived in the city neighborhood, you know, lived in that city for over 30 years. And that's kind of the life I knew up till then. And, you know, we were not rich. We were lower middle class, you know, I would say poor. I lived in an apartment building that had four apartments, and I mean, you know, not poor. We had food. My dad worked. He had a job at Anheuser-Busch. My mom stayed home, but just not much money at all. But, you know, I had a good upbringing. I went to Catholic school. You know, that's one thing they were concerned about is that I went to Catholic school, so me and my brother and sisters all did that, and no one played music. No one was a musician. There were no instruments in the house. There was no piano in the house. There was nothing of the sort. And my dad was. My parents were a lot older. I was like a oops rhythm method. You know, he was almost 50 when I was born, and you know, so there was this large gap you know, I'm born in 1970. He's born in 1922. And the next kid is 11 years older than me. My brother's 18 years older than me. These people were out of the house, you know, by the time I was 7, 8 years old. It's just me and these two old people. Like, nope. You know, the only kids were the kids in the neighborhood. So I'm hanging out with older people. And my dad did love music. I mean, he loved to listen to music. He liked to sing. And, you know, he just loved his music. And he liked his music and his music only. And his music was big band music. It was music from the 30s and 40s. And, you know, he was pretty set in his ways by the time I was around. So, in fact, just a side note, I remember my sister bought him the Willie Nelson album, Stardust, when he did all these old songs. She thought he would like that. And I remember him going, what the hell is this? This damn Hoosier redneck singing these songs. I don't know about this. he's so hard-headed like that, you know. But he ended up loving it. He listened to it because he didn't have any new records. So he ended up listening to it and eventually going, you know, this guy's pretty good. Sounds pretty good. Got a style. It's pretty good, you know, like that. So that's what I was around. And all I heard was this old music, swing music. And I finally got into some rock and roll about 7 or 8 from a kid up the street who was a little bit older that had some records. And I heard Van Halen. And it was, you know, Eruption, that guitar playing, and just never heard anything like that. I mean, not at all, like not even close. I hadn't heard Jimi Hendrix. My brother and sisters hadn't handed over their records to me yet because I was pretty young. And that was the first time I heard guitar, and I was like, wow, like what is, I didn't even know what it was. You know, I didn't know it was an instrument. I thought it was like space sounds or Star Wars or. And when the guy told me what it was, I went home and I was like, all right, like, I need a guitar because I need to make that sound. My parents were like, guitar, like who, you know, no one was even playing it. I just heard that sound and I was like, I need to make that sound. How do you make that sound? So then I got a guitar and an amp from the Sears catalog. That was in 78 when I turned 8, and I got that record, and I would play it on my dad's console, and he just hated it. He thought that he was like, Jesus, what is this noise? The hell is that guy screaming about? That sound is awful. It sounds like cats, you know. In heat, those were all his words. You know, it's terrible. And so that prompted, I got my own record player because he didn't want to hear that.
Okay.
And I got like a Snoopy record player. I'll never forget it. Had a little speaker in it, you know. And then, you know, my brother would come around. I mean, you got to understand, at that point, my brother's in his 20s. I'm 8. So my brother's like 26, you know, and he would come around and go like, well, I saw that band in concert, and we thought that guy wouldn't, we think he's faking, like he's not really doing that. That's what he said. They thought it was a recording trick or something. He goes, you know, you need to listen to this guy. And he gave me Electric Ladyland. So now I'm 8, and I've got 2 records. I've got Van Halen 1 and Electric Ladyland. And the first thing I've ever heard is Van Halen. So when I put on this Jimi Hendrix record, I think, oh, I bet it sounds just like it. And, of course, it doesn't. And I was like, oh, this is weird. What is this? You know, I mean, this is a little kid with no one guiding them, you know. I've just decided this first record's what I like. The second record I kept listening to because my brother gave it to me. He didn't give me much. And he said, this is good. And I kept listening to it, trying to like it. And, of course, eventually I did. And he gave me a Cream record. Then my sisters gave me some records. So it was all that process, you know, getting into rock and roll, and realizing, like, oh, but I like the guitar. And then I had this guitar, and no one knew how to play it, and there was no money for lessons, and I just plugged it in and would hit it. I mean, just bang on it and wonder why it doesn't sound like Eruption. Like, I thought you would just plug this thing in and that's what it did. I didn't know you had to make it do that. I mean, this is all really dumb kid stuff, but that's how it went, you know? The best thing is I lived in that neighborhood, and two blocks away from the year 1970 I was born was a guitar store called Tower Grove Music. And it was in the city, in a strip mall in the city. And they were a Fender dealer. They were a PV dealer. They had PA and pianos and some drums. But they had Fender guitars and PV guitars. And that store was, I mean, blocks from my house. And that strip plaza is where we rode our bikes to and hung out. And as soon as I got my guitar, I would start to go to that store, and I would go there every Saturday, and they would throw me out, you know, get out, you don't have any money. And, you know, it was back, now you could go to Guitar Center and beat on the guitars all day long. Back then, you couldn't even touch the guitar, you know.
Right.
Unless somebody, it was, an adult was there, and somebody looked like they had money, you know, you weren't allowed to touch the instruments. It was probably 10 years before I was able to touch one, at that store. That's the best thing that ever happened, was that store. And I got out of high school, and I went and got a job at that music store working for no money whatsoever. I quit a job that paid really good, that my mom cried about, so that I could work for free 6 days a week, 10 hours a day at that music store. I had to go get a job at a grocery store in the evenings to pay for the job that I worked 60 hours a week at, where I did not get paid. I worked 7 months for a $600 amplifier. I worked 60 hours a week for 7 months straight, and that's what I got. I mean, I can't even do the math, but I didn't care. Just the idea that they would let me come work there meant everything, and I ended up working there for 10 years. And,
wow.
I mean, this was an old school mom and pop small music store with, you know, maybe a half a dozen people tops ever working there. All guys in there who I thought were really old. I was 18 and they were, you know, 40, 50. I was like, oh my God, these are such old people. And I learned everything from them. You know, I learned, and it was all by getting yelled at. Turn that crap off. That's not music. You can't play that CD in the store. We don't listen to that. We listened to 5 CDs for at least 8 of the 10 years that I worked there. It was both CDs to the Allman Brothers Live at the Fillmore. It was Eric Clapton, John Mayall, the Beano album. It was B.B. King Live at the Regal. It was Roy Buchanan Livestock. And that might have got it traded out with a Danny Gatt CD, because it was like a 5-disc player. That is all that they listen to. And those were the only things acceptable. And any other guitar playing other than that guitar playing was, if I can curse, shit. It was beat into my head. You're a dumb kid. You don't know anything. None of that other stuff is good. And this is the only thing that's good. They were like the guys from that movie High Fidelity with John Cusack. Very judgmental, elite, Tony snob, old jaded musician guys. The best people you could be around if you wanted to go through a quick education of guitar. And that's what I got. You know, I went to college for 10 years and basically got everything else beat out of me. It was a whole process. And I learned playing in bands. You know, I started playing in bands at 18. I played in a band that played, you know, 4 nights a week, $200 a night, $50 a man. It was 2 guys and 2 girls. They were all older than me. And we played Motown. I learned all the things you have to learn. all the Stax songs, all the Motown songs, all of the Midnight Hour, Mustang Sally, Knock on Wood, you know, just all of those tunes. Chuck Berry, you better be able to play some Chuck Berry, maybe some classic rock, a couple of blues songs, B.B. King. You know, I did that. And that began another decade of, okay, wow, I didn't know you could make a living playing guitar. Okay, this is what I'm going to do. Like, I'm not working at the brewery. I'm just going to do this. If I could just hold this guitar and not ever do another job and work at the guitar shop, then I made it in my family, because they've all told me, you can't do this. We don't do this. This is not possible. You need to get a job, you know. And so once I found that in St. Louis, that was a thing. There were people working 7 nights a week all around town playing gigs. And it may not sound like a lot of money, but making 50 or 60 bucks 5 to 7 times a week, well, you know, in 1990, that was okay for a kid that was 18 or 19. I could make 1,200 bucks playing gigs, and then another, eventually, you know, another $300 or $400 a week at that music store. Well, that's pretty good. And I got married and had a kid, and that's what I did. But that all, as I kept learning and learning and learning, all this hard way, I kept thinking, man, I think there's more to this, you know? And I started to see touring people that weren't Led Zeppelin or Eric Clapton. You know, it was people like Walter Trout and Tab Benoit and Jimmy Thackeray started to come to St. Louis. And guys that played blues in St. Louis that had their own records, you know. I went to Buddy Guy's Legends in 1993. It was my first time to ever go there, to go to Chicago on my own. And we went to his club, and a girl named Joanna Connor was playing there. And she had a CD called Live in Germany, and it was on Roof. I thought it was Rough. It was on Rough Records. It's the first record ever on Rough Records. And I bought it from her on the stage, you know. She was only a few years older than me, and she was, like, cute and killing on this guitar and playing all her own music and had this great band, and she had a record. And I was like, how are you doing this? Like, this is what I want to do. How do you do this? How did you make this record? Like, what's this record label, you know? Are there other record labels besides Capitol and RCA and so, you know? I didn't even know. And then I found out there was Alligator and Blind Pig and Malico, you know. And today is so much easier, Rich. All these people have it made.
Yeah.
You just go on the internet. Yeah. Everything's there. You can be schooled in an hour. It took me a decade to learn. Decades to learn. You know, a side note. This is a funny little side note. Allie Venable, who is a great friend of mine. I'm a big supporter of Allie Venable. I think she's a wonderful person, and I like her a lot. She's very talented. And we have a nice relationship. And she loves to tease me that I'm old. And it makes me realize, well, yeah, I guess I am old, you know. I'm like 22 or something, you know. She played at Earl's Hideaway in Florida for the very first time yesterday. And she sends me a message and says, the woman there that sells the merchandise, her name is Nancy, told her, hey, you did better than Mike Zito the last time. So she texts me and says, hey, Nancy says I did better than you. And I know exactly what she means. Like, she sold more CDs than I did the last time. And I said, hey, that's great. It's your first time playing there.
Yeah.
I would hope so. I've been playing there for 13 years. So, in the long run, I'm beating you by thousands.
Well, you know, that's a tough gig to get. So, you know.
Yeah. And she says, wow, you're so old. I was like 13. When you first played there. And I said, yeah, that's how you get famous in this genre. You get old and you don't stop doing it. It's the only way it ever works.
Yeah.
For me, maybe you can do, maybe younger people can do better. But for me, that's the only way it's worked. And all those people I went to see early on that inspired me to write my own songs and to make a recording of myself and to try to leave St. Louis and go play Kansas City or go play in Chicago or go play in Springfield, Illinois. You know, that's what they were doing. They all told me, I said, how do you do this? And they said, Tab Benoit said, you do it for 20 years and then I think maybe it'll work out. If you're any good, maybe it'll work out. And now, Walter Trout told the same thing, you know.
Now, who was kind of the most inspiring to you as a songwriter? You know, who do you look at as for your inspiration when you sit down to write?
So, you know, all those years, I wrote songs when I was a kid. My mom wrote poetry. We've got books of her poems. And so I would write, too. I would also write, you know, and write with her. And I never knew that would amount to anything. And I sang all the time when I was a kid. When I couldn't play guitar at all, I always could just sing. I was loud and obnoxious, and I would sing in talent shows and whatever. And then in high school bands, I couldn't play guitar, but I would sing or I would write songs for the band. And I never gave a thought to any of those qualities. My only concern was, how do I play this guitar? Like, that was the only thing that was important to me forever. Until, and you know, look, I wrote my own songs. But that just came easy. I didn't think about it. And I sang, but I just didn't think about it. All I would think about is guitar. Because I didn't know how to do it. And I needed to know how to do it. By the time I got my first record contract with a Delta Groove, Randy Chorkoff, I said, do you like my guitar playing? He said, no, not particularly. It's not what I like. You know, I like old blues guitar playing. He said, you're like all over the place. I said, but I like your voice, and you've written some nice songs. And I'm telling you, no one's ever even said that to me before. And it changed my whole world, my whole thinking. And that I walked into a studio with David Z, Tony Bronigal, Hutch Hutchinson from Bonnie Raitt's band, Benmont Tinch from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and they all said, hey man, we really like these songs, you know, let's record these songs. It never even occurred to me like that I was writing songs.
Okay.
I was writing songs. I like songs. I like melody. I like pop type songs that have like a hook. Like, that's the music I like. That's the music I listen to. Even the blues artists that I like the songs. And it just never, ever occurred to me that, like, I had every John Hyatt record. You know, love John Hyatt.
I also
love it because Sonny Landreth or Ry Cooder's playing guitar. But that's all rubbing off on me. I'm writing songs kind of like John Hyatt, you know? I mean, I just love those songs. So as I learned that, hey, there's more to this than guitar. You have a lot to offer. These songs are pretty good. You can sing. That's when I started to pay attention to my songwriting. And again, I mean, I've learned everything the wrong way. All through trial and error and from years of just beating my head against the wall and then getting somebody to show me something. I'm very uneducated. You know, everything I've learned the hard way. I'm playing 10 years in bars, 7 nights a week. I mean, I don't think kids even do that anymore. I don't think that's a thing at all.
Well, you know, it's interesting because that's really the job. You know, there's no real money in recorded music. It's all on the road. If you're not touring, you're doing something wrong, you know?
Yeah, and even now the touring that they do is still great for them. They might do a 90-minute set or a couple of sets. It's like there's so much more involved. Then, you know, you need to bring your own PA. You can't play very loud. You need to know 40 cover songs. and you need to be able to keep the dance floor. Like,
yeah.
And you need to learn all these chords, you know? You need to learn to play country and blues and soul and funky stuff. And, you know, you need to learn these styles on your guitar. And you need to be able to sing and sing harmony. And I don't know, man. I'm so thankful. I feel like I'm maybe like the last generation that did that job. I mean, there's certainly still cover bands and tribute bands, and it's just not maybe quite the same for young people anymore. Like, I don't think they even consider that, you know, as something they might do. And maybe that's good. I don't think so. So my songwriting, I would say, it's definitely, I love John Hiatt. I love all those stories. I love Wright Cooter. I think, you know, those are wonderful songwriters. I love Lyle Lovett. Gary Nicholson, and, you know, I love all the Delbert McClinton albums and all those story songs. And then I love blues. Those are the hardest songs to write. To write a good blues song is the hardest thing. To write a bad blues song is super easy, and there's a million of them.
Yes, there is.
The worst. But to actually get something that's catchy and simple and fun and actually has something to it, a little
authenticity
hook, yeah, it's not easy. So you know, I don't think I didn't really write any blues songs on my new album at all, not to go there so quick.
Okay, well, you know, blues to me is, you know, if you're cataloging the human condition and touching people at that deep emotional level, to me, that's the blues. You know, that's where it lives, you know?
Right.
Now, you know, one of the things that you've done in the course of your career is you've gained a reputation as a producer. You know, going into the studio and helping artists craft their sound. When you go into the studio to work on your stuff, what is kind of your process that allows you to capture what you're looking for?
You mean like with another artist?
Well, even with yourself. I mean, do you like to work live off the floor? Do you like to track it? You know, what do you do that gives you that sound, that signature, that, you know, when you hear it, you know that's Mike Zito?
Well, I like, I'm a lot, I'm probably, you know, gosh, again, just such a process of, even when I couldn't really, you know, I couldn't play guitar in high school to play in the cover bands. I really couldn't do that very well in my 20s, but especially in high school. So I just wrote my own songs, because then no one could tell me I'm playing it wrong, right? And I would record my own songs in high school. I would go to that music store and rent a four-track recorder and a drum machine. For the weekend, I'd save up money. I'd get $30, and I'd rent them each $15 each for the weekend. And I'd go home, and I would plug my guitar in that drum machine, and I would record my songs on a four-track recorder. I learned how to do that, how to record my songs with the drum machine and mix it down and really spend time trying to mix the levels on that four-track recorder so that I could put my tape in the tape player in the car and let my friends hear my song and go like, hey, what do you think? How's that sound? You know, like I would put it in and have them go, hey, what is this? Like hoping they didn't know it was me. Like, what's this new music you got? But it was me, you know. So I did that for a long time, and I did that for a long time on my own up until 1998, where I got it, where I started to learn about all these blues albums and stuff, and I said, no, everything's got to be live, and we got to go in the studio live, and the band's got to play live, and you got to press record. And we cannot do anything over. So whatever we do has got to stay. And we should start drinking.
Okay.
So that was like my, you know, I was headed in the right direction. The drinking was dumb, but I wanted to capture like what we sound like when we played on a great night at Saturday night. We were drinking and we were really loose. And so we did that. My very first record, Blue Room, that's how it's recorded. We're all been drinking beer and it's all one take and live. And as time went on, you know, and I got to work with these big producers and I got to work with record labels and big, you know, big studios, go to Hollywood and make a record and all that stuff. You know, again, whole process, and I'm learning. And I learned that even on the first record, the Today album, we're going to try to record this live. That's what David Z says. He says, look, you need to listen to everybody. We're going to press record, and if we, and I don't want to have to do it again unless we have to. But we want to get it live. I don't want you to play the guitar and go, oh, well, I'll go back and I can fix that. No, 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 no. Because singing and playing is going to have a whole different feel to it. And that's what we want to record. And we did. Almost, you know, 90% of that record is like that. And I learned a lot. So by the Pearl River next record, it was like, we went in New Orleans with David Z, and we're like, hey, we're cutting this live. And I mean, man, we cut 14 tracks the first day. I mean, live. Everything is no vocals, guitar. I mean, it's all one. There's no rhythm guitars on that record. It's just because, just like you've been playing at a club, you know. We did the same thing on Greyhound. As everything went on, we would. That's how we did these records. And I got it in my head like, hey, man, this is what we got to do. So when I get in the studio with Girls with Guitars in 2010, that's my vibe. Is I want you to play live. And that's what Thomas Roof likes. He's like, yeah, man, we want it live. We want it raw. And I'll be honest, for the most part, that's how we want it. No matter what kind of music it is, we want it to not be perfect. Doesn't mean you play bad, of course not.
No.
But we...
You want it to be authentic.
Exactly. Anybody that's interested in listening to this style of music is certainly not interested in perfection. That's not even what this music's about. It's about feeling and emotion and things happening. And there's all kinds of beauty in the first take. You know, when everybody doesn't quite know what they're doing. Something may happen. That's what I, you know, you get young artists in and their fear is the same fear I had, you know, oh, I don't know. I need to go back. I need to fix this. No, no. They don't trust themselves. They don't, this isn't good enough. They're comparing themselves to the greatest recordings in the world. And I have to tell them, listen, this is not going to be the best record you ever make. Okay. But it'll be the best record you make right now. So, it, just let it happen. Don't worry about that. You're going to make more records, and they're going to get better. And I'll make sure that you don't embarrass yourself. You got to trust me. I'm not going to let you do something that is not going to look good on you. And that's a big part of producing someone, is getting them to trust you and to go along. And look, it's a varied level. There's going to be a point in any record where the artist is going to say, no, I don't want to do that. Or no, I want to do that. I don't agree with you. So that's how it works.
Okay.
And overall, most of the records I've made with younger artists, I can only think of one that it did not go that way. They've all gone well. There's always been one point where something, you know, we butt heads on something, but it never ends badly. Or, you know, I mean, I'm easygoing overall, but, and mostly they trust me. I can only think of one record I made where we just didn't jive, you know? So I would say my average is pretty good. And I think overall, the majority of the records I've had the honor of working on, like, I'm proud of them. I listened to them again. I think, oh, that's a pretty good record. You know, oh, that was good. I remember, oh, I really liked, you know, they hold up. I love everything that Samantha Fish has ever done, and I'm her biggest fan, and always have been, and told her before she ever got a record deal, you could be a star, and she's exactly what I thought she would be. She's a star.
Yeah.
But Black Wind Howlin' to me is still, that's her best record. Is maybe because I did it, maybe. Maybe that's the style, that was that style she was doing at that time. Maybe that's my style. You know, like, that's what I like. That's probably true. I mean, certainly everything she's done afterwards has been bigger and better. But I always think, man, that record sounds good. Like, it's got everything. And she's so powerful on there, you know. So I like things to be honest and real. Now you jump ahead and we do Masterpiece with Albert Castillo. Well, there's no band there. You know, that's not a band in the studio playing live. But I'll tell you what, it is live and off the cuff and authentic as anything, and more so than, because we don't even have a room full of experienced musicians to make our music sound good. It was like a kid back in high school with a four-track recorder. And when I told them the idea, I can't think of anybody else that would have said okay than Albert.
Yeah.
When I said, hey, he goes, well, who's going to play drums? I said, I don't know. I will. I said, you can. He goes, I don't know how to play drums. I said, well, I don't either. We'll figure it out. He goes, are you kidding me? I said, no. I said, come on, man. I said, we don't need anybody else in the way of your message here. This is a strong album. You've got something serious to say. And it needs to be me and you and the songs. And we don't need a bunch of flashy musicians playing good, getting in the way of your songs. And he said, okay, I'll do it. I'm telling you, Rich, he stayed in my backyard. We woke up in the morning. We go out there. I go, okay, what do you got? He goes, I got this song. He played on the acoustic guitar. I go, all right, what can we do? I don't know. Well, we can use a drum machine. We can make a drum loop. I can play the drums half-ass. What do we think works? What's this song about? And I'm telling you, the two of us sat there and from nothing, with very little studio experience of how to do this shit, we figured out how to make music. And we made some kind of rhythmic bed of music that seemed to emulate what the energy of the song was. And I couldn't be more proud of that record. And I don't know that you can do that record all the time. It was very hard. It's the hardest thing we ever did.
Well, I know Albert was real proud of it. You know, he's definitely proud of that record.
I'm super proud of it. It's so hard. It was so hard to do.
Now,
and I'll go back and I think, how the hell did we do it? And I sent it to Ruth, and he goes, no way. No way. I'm not putting this out. Like, are you kidding me? What is this? Who played drums? He goes, who played drums on this? That drummer's terrible. I said, I did. He goes, why are you playing drums on my records? Well, I don't know. Because I'm the right drummer for that record. You don't need a good drummer. It sounds weird, you know? But I guess my point is, I've opened up over the years now to being a little more coming back to being a kid again. Like, hey, man, we got all this technology and shit laying around. What can we do with it? I mean, sometimes it's like, let's just go put the band in there and press record. And sometimes, like, yeah, I don't know, man, we need to do something different. What can we do? Like, just what can we do? You know, sometimes I need to go have a producer produce me the way any artist does. Sometimes I go, I don't know what I'm doing anymore. I need something new. I'll go to Nashville. Tom Hambridge, will you make a record for me? Yes. Then you get that record. That record doesn't sound like any of the other records, you know. If you're going to have a career as an artist, you need to have different ideas to me.
Oh, yeah.
Different things that happen. And so, you know, Albert tells me again, I've made 1, 2, 3, 4 records with Albert now. One of them's a live record. And he goes, what are we going to do next? And I'm like, I don't know. Should I do a record with you? Maybe somebody else should do a record. No, no, I want you to do the record. Why? Well, I appreciate that, but I don't know. Like, you may need to just go do something else. Like, you know, I mean, listen, it's all just about, look back at all of your favorite artists, especially in blues, when you got a, like, say, God plays guitar and sings, like Albert King or B.B. King or Freddie King. Go back and look through those catalogs. Look at Freddie King and look at where he starts and where he ends up. They are not the same record at all. He's making 50s, almost backing track instrumental songs, like, you know, little surf, bluesy cuts. And old blues songs to all the way to Shelter Records and, you know, big productions and 70s rock sounding stuff. You know, Albert King goes to London and makes these funk records. You know, that's what you do. You take these people and even Muddy, you know, making that, which is not a fan favorite, that Electric Mud, but, you know, they just, you take an artist and what can we do with them?
Right. You innovate.
Yeah. Buddy Guy Sweet Tea is a great record. It's a great, that's a great example of what else do you do with Buddy Guy? And then, well, let's go back to Mississippi and do this hill country thing and make it trashy and tune the guitars down. And so, you know, I'm pretty open. I always want things to be honest and real. I'm not always about everybody taking their time to really figure out exactly what they want to play. But I will tell you, on the last record, Resurrection, that's the most time I've ever spent making a record. I've never done that before. And that was a new experience for me. It was a brand new experience. Had all the time in the world.
Now, you also started your own record company. So you have this unique perspective on the industry, whereas you're an artist, you're a producer, and you own a record company that has other artists on it. And, you know, we're looking now at a consumer that doesn't even look at recorded music as a product. How has this affected you as not only an artist, but also as a record company?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I try to remember or think that, you know, sure, but there's, you know, there's still our fan base, of our music lover fan base. They still listen to Spotify, they listen to Apple Music, they go to YouTube, whatever, but they still buy physical product from the artist. It's obviously not what it was 20 or 25 years ago. I get it, you know, because that was 25 years ago. That was the only way to listen to it. The hard part now is not getting people to listen to it outside of your core fan base. It's that they don't even know you exist. You know,
right.
It's if you're not into this music, you're not hearing about it. It's different. You know, selling 10,000 records today is like was selling 40 or 50 25 years ago, you know. Selling 20 or plus is like, oh, okay, well, now. I swear, if you could sell 25,000 or more records in one of the, you know, you could get a record deal with, you could get a bigger labels coming around wanting to know who's this, you know. That's
right.
Pretty crazy. But, again, all of that is based around you've got a fan base, which means you're touring, you've got a social media presence, you're interacting with your fans. And it's so, you know, it's still the same game as it was in the 1950s when people were selling 45s out of the trunks at the shows. And my kids and I just watched That Thing That You Do last night.
Yeah.
And my wife just goes, wow, you know, it's different to see it now that we own a record label, because what does that kid do? He says, yeah, we should make a record. They make 45s to sell for $1 a piece at the pizza place. And that's the whole thing that sets it all in motion.
Yep.
You know, they make that recording. There's nothing different about it. You can still do that. So, no, we're not getting rich with our record label. We're always trying to find new fans, new people. We think that there's a lot more people that will like the music we're putting out than just our core Blues World fans. But we love our core Blues World fan. We don't want to alienate them. We want to make sure that they're getting music, new music. There's a fan base out there. They love the new music. But we're trying to find new fans, you know.
Okay.
It's the same old thing. Every time we get to see some young people or something new, and they're like, wow, hey, man, I really like this music. They always say that, you know. And they buy a CD. And I'll go, do you have a CD player? No. People don't buy CDs anymore to listen to them.
No, it's a souvenir.
It's a souvenir. We have download cards at the table of the new album. If you buy a CD, you can have the download card for free. We just want you to listen to the new music, and would you buy it from us so we could pay for it, you know? So you can come up and go, I'll just take the download card. I don't even want a CD. Or I'll take the CD, or, you know, we got a vinyl record, same thing. And they want the record or the CD. I'm telling you, I can't even give the download cards away. Because they're not, I don't know. People are weird.
Right. You know, I don't think anyone wants to store anything, whether it's a CD or a download.
Right.
You know,
they're streaming it.
Yeah.
They listen to it whenever they want to listen to it. But if they like what they saw there and they had an experience and it was really fun for them, they want a souvenir.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, that's the way it works.
Now, you had mentioned about social media and staying connected to your fan base. And one of the things that has been a result of the pandemic and shutting down touring is a lot of artists have now moved on to social media, onto the internet, whether it's live streaming or making videos or doing content creation, working their social media to stay connected to their fans. What are some of the things that you've been doing during the pandemic that allowed you to stay connected?
I'm so sorry. Tell me that last part one more time.
What were you doing on social media or, you know, on the internet that allowed you to stay connected to your fans during the pandemic?
During COVID?
Yeah.
During the pandemic? I mean, you know, like anybody, I probably learned more about, I wasn't even, you know, I was aware of, course, you know, I'm trying to share everything on social media. It was not of my priority because I'm in we're traveling.
Right.
And touring and on the road and on the move and going. So I'm not always doing that. I'm doing the physical thing, and then we have someone that that's helping me, you know, do those things. Hold on one second, Rich.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm finishing the interview. I'm sorry. I don't mean to mess that up. This is a live recording.
Not a problem.
We'll keep going.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing, you know, we get stuck at home, and then there's no gigs. And, kind of follow the lead. I start seeing people go live. I started going live. Of course, the first 2 weeks, I was, locked in my house because I come back from Europe and we had to, quarantine, and there was, we didn't even know what it was yet. It was like, so I would start doing this live thing, I'm stuck in the backyard, I can't go outside, you know, seems like a million years ago. But that certainly, the fans really liked that. That interaction, that just talking to them, sing a song, tell them what's going on, you know. And so I did a whole lot of that. I did a whole lot of the live stream. I did interviews and interviewed people. And, you know, I got really busy really quick doing a lot of stuff. And then everybody got really busy really quick. And the internet was, like, you know, flooded with stuff. And I just kind of backed off, you know. I was like, okay, that's enough. I've done that a lot. And, you know, one, other people need a chance. And two, it's like, you can't go on every day and go, hey, can I have some money? Hey, can we have some money? Hey, we don't have any money. Can we have some money? Like, after a while, you're like, well, everybody else is getting out of work too, not just musicians. We can't, you know, you can't just keep going asking people for money. There's got to be other things to do. So, you know, I got busy in the studio, you know, writing songs, recording songs, working on music, doing, we got contracts to do backing tracks for the band, and, you know, all kinds of different work. So I stayed busy with social media, but it leveled off sometime last summer. And that big rush kind of ended, and I kind of gave everybody a break, and it seemed to work. I don't want to brag. I feel like I was always a little ahead of the curve,
right,
the whole year, but it certainly made me very aware now that, you know, people are on social media, they're paying attention, they want interaction. And they want it quick. They want fast, short, and a lot of it.
Yeah, you know? Yep, that they do.
And then sometimes you stop and you don't do it for a week or two and give them a break. And then you come back and give them something new. It's a thing. I mean, certainly I realized last year I would see people that had careers that had never toured. And they built a career on YouTube or online. Well, the pandemic didn't affect them at all.
Right.
They were flourishing. And it made me think for a hot second, like, so I'm, like, old. Like, I'm doing things, like, really old school. Like, I'm not up to standards here in the modern world. I'm driving around collecting money door to door, town to town. That's old. But as the year went on, I just thought, man, I don't care if it's old or not. That's what I'm doing. I mean, I'll do the other thing for whatever is necessary. And if anybody can help me or say I need to do this, you know, I do it. But I'm not going to go make that my job.
No, well, you know, going on the road is, that's the job of a musician. You know,
right.
You got to get out there and get face to face. Well, you know, I really appreciate you doing this, Mike, and coming on the show. And we're going to give everyone out there a double shot from your new release. You guys are going to really love this. Turn it up loud. Screw those neighbors. We're going to have some fun tonight.
the shadow. You were standing strong at home. Knowing something had to give. How could we ever just go on? You knew this love was meant to be.
Yeah, we need a ransom.
something else.
Whether you're an independent artist looking to take their career to the next level, or you're a fan that just loves to discover new artists and new original music, making a scene has exactly what you're looking for. For the indie artist, we have articles on music business, gear reviews, recording techniques, and interviews with industry professionals. For the fan, we introduce you to new artists every day with our in-depth artist interviews and insightful CD reviews. Nobody gives you more. Making a Scene truly is the number one resource for the indie artist and the fans that love them. Go to makingascene.org and become part of the indie revolution.
Gonna rock the shit.